Welcome to the Weather Pod. My name is Alan Thorpe and I'm an atmospheric scientist. I've worked as a professor of meteorology at the University of Reading, as the head of the UK Met Office's Hadley Centre, and most recently as Director General of the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecasts.
And I'm David Rogers. I'm an oceanographer turned meteorologist, a former chief executive of the UK Met Office, and now a consultant with the World Bank, helping countries improve their weather, hydrological and disaster management systems and services.
Weather and climate information is a truly international resource involving the work of many individuals and organisations right across the public, private and academic sectors, which make up what's called the global weather enterprise.
Most importantly, we'll investigate why the effective use of weather information requires the public, private and academic sectors to cooperate, collaborate and form partnerships. Using real-life case studies, we'll analyse the successes and the failures and identify the barriers standing in the way of such cooperation for the benefit of all.
WeatherPod will explore how weather information is produced and how and where it is made available. We'll also examine how it's used across the globe to save lives, to make business and society more efficient, and to build resilience to the rapidly growing impacts of extreme weather and climate change.
As many people know, extreme weather often impacts the poorest the hardest. So we'll look at how weather and climate information is used by the richer and more developed countries and by the less well-off and less developed ones, which also host the largest part of the world's rapidly growing population. We're particularly interested in the ways they use weather and climate information, the differences and things in common, and the lessons we can learn from each other.
In each episode, we'll invite a leading expert to join us here in the studio to discuss a key topic. And alongside this, we'll have a section called Wow, That's Interesting, where we choose a newsworthy story or two about the global weather enterprise.
Right, now it's time for Wow, That's Interesting.
Wow!
So, Alan, what did you choose for Wow, That's Interesting for this episode?
Thanks, David. I found a recent news item from ECMWF, the European Weather Centre, that was really interesting to me about filling the observational gaps that have arisen because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And it seems that between mid-March and mid-April, the number of aircraft reports received at ECMWF went down by as much as 75% before levelling out. And of course, that reduction was because of the reduction in aviation during the pandemic. A private company, Spire, that has a constellation of satellites in space, offered to provide its radio occultation observations free of charge for now to help mitigate this loss of aircraft data. So building on the work on the data by European Space Agency, EUMETSAT and the UK Met Office, ECMWF was quickly able to move from quality assessment and passive monitoring to active assimilation.
Wow. So what do radio occultation observations tell us about the atmosphere?
Well, as radio waves emitted by GPS transmitters, these are the transmitters that we use for global positioning anyway. But as these radio waves are emitted, they travel through the atmosphere and their path is bent by variations in the atmospheric refractive index, which itself is dependent on temperature. So a satellite in the Spire constellation receives this signal, thereby determining this bending angle. And so these observations give detailed information on vertical temperature profiles.
So what impact on the forecast are these additional observations having?
The ECMWF scientist Chris Burrows said, and I quote him, "The additional radio occultation data have improved forecast against a range of metrics in terms of the relative impact of different types of observations on forecasts. Since the end of March, aircraft-based observations have gone down substantially and radio occultation data have gone up in broadly equal measure."
So are these extra RO observations coming in significant numbers to make a difference?
I think, in fact, the Spire data roughly double the number of individual observations from radio occultation that routinely are assimilated into the ECMWF weather forecasts. In my view, this is not only a very good news story regarding forecast quality during COVID, but also it shows the interplay between the public and private sectors. I hope it signals an increasing level of trust between the sectors so that real partnerships can be forged that benefit all parties.
Are there other examples of the private sector helping out?
Yes, indeed. One is a company called FlyHT, which in collaboration with UMetNet and the UK Met Office, this company has made its TAMDAR aircraft observations available for free for now, again, to respond to the reduction in other observations during the pandemic. On 12th of May, ECMWF started actively using some of these data to fill some of the gaps.
WeatherPod with Alan Thorpe and David Rogers.
In this episode, we're going to be talking about the role of the academic sector in the global weather enterprise. And I'm really delighted that we have with us David Parsons, an old friend and colleague from the University of Oklahoma. Hi, David.
Hello. How are you?
Good, thanks. Just for our listeners, I thought I'd say a few words about your career. You did a PhD with Peter Hobbs at the University of Washington, had 25 years at NCAR as a research scientist. You were at Meteo France. You visited University of Reading when I was there and for a year. You then went to the WMO in Geneva and provided leadership for the ThorpeX program before going to the University of Oklahoma, where you've only recently left the position of the director of the Department of Meteorology. David Rogers, I think you'd perhaps like to kick off the conversation.
Yeah. Hi, Dave. Welcome to the podcast. We'd like to start to think about cooperation between the public and private and academic sectors. And we know that the academic sector plays a huge role in this enterprise. How would you characterize it?
I think the academic sector plays a critical role in three different areas. The most obvious is probably the education and training. Atmospheric science is a difficult field, a lot of mathematics, physics, some chemistry. So the education and training, but also the academic sector plays an important role in research breakthroughs, applied research. And then also, I think there's an important role for people in the academics to for outreach and communications. As teachers, as instructors, we should have some skill in communicating with the public. So I think those three areas are probably the critical contributions.
So at University of Oklahoma, you have an excellent example of academic, public, private sector partnerships. So how did that come about?
I think it really came about from the leadership at the time. Probably 10, 15, 20 years ago, the National Severe Storms Laboratory moved to Norman. The university wanted to get private and public academic partnerships together. So it was really the leadership. Jeff Kimple was the dean or provost then, and then the president of the university. And it was difficult. We combined the government and university activities into one building. Just getting that building funded through state funding and federal funding was quite a challenge. So I think it was really the leadership at the time that had a vision of bringing people together and even bringing companies like Weather News from Japan to have an innovation center here in Norman. So it was, I think, the leaders of the private, public, and academic sectors coming together.
And that's evolving. I mean, you see this growing?
Yes, I think that over the years, there's been different additions. A cooperative institute, SIMS, was added with NOAA that bridges research to academics. The training branch came here. And there's been a slow addition of more and more private sector companies onto the area and onto the research campus. So it's growing. There's challenges, but people have new ideas. Internships for students have popped up. We have so many internships, sometimes we have trouble filling them. So it's growing, it's evolving, and I think generally improving.
It's one of the few places, the National Weather Center in the world, I guess, where you have the three sort of sectors together, academia, National Weather Service, and an industry side by side. What is the perceived benefits of having all three together? I could imagine that, for example, for a university professor, it might seem like an additional overhead to be collaborating with the National Weather Service or with industry rather than doing, you know, their usual research on their own. What's the value added, do you think, of bringing the three together?
Well, Alan, I think you know the university professors quite well, and the personalities are pretty variable, and some faculty just move along and do their research on their own. But for a large percentage of the faculty, you wind up having people on the applied research side involved in the funding of graduate students. I think over a third of our graduate students are funded by government entities that related to the things happening in Norman. So I think that it broadens the research. Students like to make a difference, and having the public sector involved is quite an interesting challenge. The private sector is, I think, a little more difficult for direct collaboration with the faculty, but it's been really a great opportunity for student employment. Weather News, the example I gave earlier, I think there's 60 or 70 of our students that are now working in Amsterdam, Tokyo, or in Norman in the three branches. So I think it varies a bit. The private sector, sometimes there's challenges. The public sector, it's more a direct cooperation, but it works, and it works different ways for different faculty.
So as a follow-up, Dave, I'm sort of curious as to your view on what does the National Weather Service feel it gets from this collaboration? Because as we know, all partnerships and collaboration, you know, take effort and can be sometimes difficult to keep going and to make successful.
Well, I think that it's actually a great example of a partnership, particularly on storm timescales up to minutes, hours, perhaps even the first day or two of the forecast. The Cooperative Institute here, SIMS, Cooperative Institute for Mesoscale Meteorology, is in a sense a wonderful bridge of bringing together people that are interested in short-term forecasting. Storm Prediction Center is here on the operational side. And there's actually a lot of give and take between this Cooperative Institute as the research bridge, our students and faculty, and operations in the Storm Prediction Center, and to some extent, the local Weather Service office. I think there's one very good example of that is the spring experiment that happens every year. It brings together our faculty with people from the operational side, the Cooperative Institute, people working on new modeling techniques. European Center in the Met Office sometimes sends people over, and sometimes there's a scientist from low-income developing nations that come to see what's happening. So I think that's been a very good focal point for a lot of years of bringing people together. What I've heard is the Weather Service is quite happy with this cooperation.
The cooperative institutes, of which there are many in the U.S., are actually a great bridge between basic research and applied research, and I think that's where they have excelled in all the institutions where they're housed. So they feed into NOAA research, and then from that they feed into the Weather Service and then transitioning research to operations. And it's a very well thought out structure, which actually doesn't exist in many other countries.
WeatherPod with Alan Thorpe, David Rogers.
David, I guess to be devil's advocate, particularly at a time when we have COVID to think about, you know, why is it necessary, in a sense, to have all this in the same building, Dave Parsons? I mean, it's obviously scientists often collaborate at a distance and can be very effective in doing that. But I think one of the distinctive things you've got with the National Weather Center is people are actually next door to each other and can, you know, physically be co-located to work together. Is that, how does that work? Is it really that important to have people together?
Well, I think we're living in a world where these distance collaborations can work well. I mean, there are many examples of that, but I think just having people meet at even sometimes social functions, seminars, colloquiums, you get a chance to see what each other is doing, and the give and take, having people from the NOAA side and the Cooperative Institute on in the classroom sometimes, also on graduate student committees, interacting with graduate students frequently. So I think there is an added bonus of having the co-locations. And there are other international examples too. I know the cooperative institutes, the Ertl Institutes that were started in Germany are also very novel. What they do is they have to have a co-lead from the operational side and the academic side. So it's not just somebody throwing an idea over the fence when they finish something. People have very good access to the data on the academic side because the operational folks are involved. So there are other wonderful examples, the joint institutes in the UK also. So it's a model of this close proximity does have benefits, although admittedly, people collaborate over great distances.
But just before we move on finally from this topic, I think the question we always sort of ask is how effective in a way are we at these partnerships? Because, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, for example, you've co-authored a paper with a scientist from another continent, say, or something like that. But that seems to me anyway, a little bit different from actually having a partnership where in a way, both sides, say the National Weather Service and an academic, both sides are actually getting something out of the partnership that otherwise they would either have to do themselves or find another way to deliver. I guess I'm worried that we don't always put enough effort into how to structure the partnerships.
I think, you've been on one of our review committees, and I think how the partnerships are structured can always be a little bit improved. And you go through different research problems, people come together and then solve a problem and then separate. So I think the proximity is good. You mentioned the international collaboration. I think this is something else that's really, really important in the U.S. and many other developing countries. The increase in productivity for scientific researchers in many fields is actually closely tracked by the degree of international collaborations. And this is perhaps a bit surprising, but as things change and developing countries build up their scientific capabilities and their resources, so these local partnerships are really important in how they're structured, but you know, the great increase in productivity actually has come around from international collaborations.
WeatherPod with Alan Thorpe and David Rogers.
I think maybe we move on to another related sort of topic now, and that is about the access and availability and importance of data. That is either observational data or modeling data or climate simulations for the academic sector to be able to do cutting-edge research. And I wondered, Dave, if you had a perspective on that sort of sharing and access of data for the academic community.
I think it's really important. And as the private sector grows in taking data and not just, say, using measurements taken by weather services and other groups, I think the access of the data sets to the research community for teaching the next generation of scholars is really, really critical. And I think that sometimes the benefits of this are overlooked by some private sector companies. And what you really benefit from having people trained who look at your data set, there's many examples of people finding problems and errors in the measurements when it's exposed to the academic community. So I think it's just really important. And an open data policy has really been the foundation of a lot of the successes of the Global Weather Enterprise and the improvement in weather prediction systems. So it's critical.
How would you characterize, do you think there are any bottlenecks in data availability? I mean, you mentioned private sector data, and of course data of various types comes from all sorts of organizations, and of course under different conditions of either having to be paid for or somehow the government has already paid for it. What do you think the main bottlenecks might be at the moment?
Sometimes it's national policies. For example, a weather service will try to sell its data for profit and not make it readily available. So sometimes it's the national priorities. I think things have to change across all three sectors. Sometimes the private sector doesn't realize the benefits of having their data more out in the open. I realize there's certain things that are proprietary that need to be protected. But even on the academic side, there's been examples of, say, the private sector making data available, perhaps even proprietary information, and that data then being shared beyond the original scope. So I think that all three sectors need to come together to realize the importance of this. Really how open data has been a foundation of our successes in numerical weather prediction. So I think all three sectors have to have an open mind and work towards this goal.
David, do you want to come in here?
No, I think it's actually related a lot. My concern with data is a lot to do with how in developing countries, so many institutions sit on their data and they see it as a resource. And unfortunately, they actually impede the development of the whole field. And it's a challenge for all of us to try to change that structure. And I was wondering, Dave, from your experience, how do we go about doing that?
I think that when it comes to the weather services, the WMO, the World Meteorological Organization, can play a large role in pushing these nations to a more open data policy. And there's been work, the private partnership documents that have been put out by the World Bank that really show the value of having the three sectors involved, the value of having open data. When you have open data, it could be used for agriculture, for tourism. It actually makes the weather service more valuable to the nation and perhaps more likely to be funded by that nation or by organizations supporting development. So it's just a critically important topic, and it's not just data taken by these low-income nations, but their access to the very large data streams produced by numerical weather prediction systems, by satellite systems, by climate modeling. Large data sets are sometimes very difficult to work with if you're in some low-income nations.
WeatherPod with Alan Thorpe and David Rogers.
Do you think there's a role for the more advanced countries, economically advanced countries, academic community in really helping developing countries understand this? We often see that a problem that even the sharing of data from the public sector to the academic sector in developing countries doesn't happen. And it's a challenge, even if that data, that information is actually really available through the global census, it's often the channel for that information comes through the National Meteorological Hydrological Services, and the academics in those countries don't get a chance to access it and use it. Can you see a way that we could change that?
I wish that there was a simple solution. I think there's several paths. For example, having some research cooperation. I think the AMA example in Africa was a wonderful source of bringing people together, actually getting people in the nations of Africa, North Africa, Sub-Sahel, interested in atmospheric science. There was a big increase in PhDs in these countries, modernization of the weather services, forecast handbooks. So, you know, that's one example, is to have these regional type of projects, experiments that can actually lead to fundamental shifts. Those are often built around forecast problems that are important in those nations, but also have global implications of improving measurements in those areas, improve the global models. So there's that way. And then I think there's also projects you've been involved in, some in national projects, regional projects that associated with the World Bank, where funding is brought in and there's a trust built on both sides. It's an on-the-ground operation, and there's shifts that way. But I think just having people of the developed nations telling people that it needs to be done differently is is a challenge. You need to actually get on the ground and get involved, whether it's in a research project, whether it's an educational shift in training, whether it's development projects. I think getting people on the ground in those nations and getting trust between the sectors, between the partners in the developing countries, the researchers, the public sector, whether enterprise is really critical.
I'm glad to hear you mentioned the AMA program, which I think is actually a beacon of the way to interact with colleagues in other countries. But I guess just to be sort of devil's advocate for a moment, I mean, one of the issues in the developing countries is that often the academic community in metrology is not particularly strong. And I just wonder if you think that academics in the developed world, such as the US or Europe or Asia, whether they should feel a kind of, I'm not sure if the word responsibility is right, but do you think they should feel motivated to try to help to build up the capacity of academic research in some of the developing countries? Because I guess we would benefit both ways from that.
That's a really good point, and it's a complex issue that very often academics in developing nations, they're funded to do science that's cutting edge by the scientific research agencies. So sometimes there's barriers to this cooperation. And I think that the responsibility to change that, the academic sector has to have a role, but it's also bringing the three sectors together. If you have a very small atmospheric science department and it's just training a few people for the local weather service, it's going to be very hard to build and sustain. But if you're having free data, you're having sharing information, you have partners in developing nations, then there's going to be more people that can be employed. Having private sector partners, they're going to also be involved. So if you build up the whole enterprise, then there's a greater need for academics and education and training. And I think realizing that if you want to do development, just the importance of high impact weather, disasters, and climate change on the changing demographics of the world. This is a problem that people need to come together to solve. The explosion in urbanization means that the people that are infected by and climate change, the people, say, living along coastlines are dramatically affected. So I think it's a big problem. The academic sector has a role, but if you build all three sectors together and realize it's part of the development stream that plays an important role in people's lives, then things can change.
Dave, do you see we talked about cooperative institutes, the NOAA cooperative institutes. Do you see the potential for applying that model on a regional scale in the developing world? That because those institutions are mostly focused on applied research, they can bring on one end the academic community and on the other they bring the operational community together. Do you think there's a role for that kind of boundary institution?
Well, David, I actually think that's a brilliant idea because sometimes when you have a research experiment, AMA might be a difference. I think it had a longer impact, but you know, people come together, they take measurements from the sophisticated instrumentation in the developed world and go home, maybe write a few papers, and it's difficult to change things. I think that idea of these cooperative institutes, be it regional, especially if there was a path to bring the different sectors together, I think that's a wonderful idea.
WeatherPod with Alan Thorpe and David Rogers.
You mentioned several times the term open data, and I think this is a phrase that's used quite a lot, and of course it's relevant to the overall questions of data sharing, including, I have to say, with the developing countries. I wonder if you could just tell us a bit what pops into your mind when you're saying open data. What's it like? How do you know it when you see it?
I think that the modern world we live in, having internet access, being able to pull in data directly is a wonderful thing. I think there's other data that's perhaps a bit proprietary, and it's important to, you know, if you're taking a company's data, they really don't want you to take that data and compete with them for services. So I think the TIGI, the Thorpex Integrated Grand Global Ensemble, is a really great idea of an open data source, because there's a time delay. So a nation or a company can essentially use that for their direct benefit, but then people doing research can get it with a delay and download what they need and go from there and have it archived. So I guess easy access, archivability, having some metadata explaining how the data was taken, the problems, the ability to share information would be important. And there is data that's difficult to share in real time. And going back to David's example in the developing nations, then I think having this real-time access for individuals that can use the data is very important too. The basic protecting property and saving lives is the Weather Service's goal, but the tourism, agriculture, other companies that are private sector is really great to be set up on that. So I'm afraid that's probably a long, rambling answer to your short question, Alan. But
it's a good answer, I think. And what I liked about your answer is you didn't go into saying that open data is to do with free data. This is a phrase that's also used, free data, which I find a little bit confusing, because in a sense, all data has to be procured, and that incurs a cost. So all data costs something. I think on our behalf, thank you so much for taking part in this discussion. I think it's been very wide ranging, and you've been very open with your answers and your input to this discussion. So thank you so much. And we look forward to the next time we see you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me. And I look forward to seeing you all in person someday soon. So thank you.
WeatherPod with Alan Thorpe and David Rogers.
Over to you, David, for your newsworthy nugget.
Wow!
I thought it would be interesting to share a story from our colleague A.R. Sabaya, the director of RIMES in Bangkok. As you know, from the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, we faced the possibility of a major meteorological event impacting places with a large number of infections. Well, we didn't have to wait long. In May, supercyclone Umpan threatened India and Bangladesh. In India's Odisha state, disaster managers had to cope with the combined impact of COVID-19 and the tropical cyclone. The cyclone threatened the coastal districts, which were also home to about 80% of the state's confirmed cases, further complicated by the fact that most cyclone shelters were being used as COVID-19 quarantine centres.
Okay, David, isn't it right that Odisha managed to keep the number of COVID cases relatively low because of quarantining infected people in centres?
Yes, they had about 3,700 cases with not much community transmission at that time. But now the shelters were needed for evacuees from the cyclone. So using forecasts from the Indian Met Department and other global sensors, the disaster managers were able to assess the cumulative risks of heavy rain, high winds and COVID-19 on the exposed population. Acting quickly and quite early, 4 days ahead of landfall, they identified more than 560 cyclone and flood shelters and over 7,000 buildings capable of housing up to 1.2 million evacuees.
Wow, that seems like a huge effort. What about the COVID-19 infections while they were doing this?
Well, they also retested people who had been quarantined for COVID-19. Positive cases were moved to other safe and secure quarantine centres outside of the areas likely to be impacted by the cyclone.
So what happened?
Well, in the end, about 200,000 people were evacuated to about 4,000 shelters and safe buildings, which were prepared and occupied based on strict COVID-19 guidelines. Unfortunately, three people, including an infant, were killed, but there was apparently no increase in COVID-19 cases.
That's really interesting. What do you think, David, would be the lessons that we could learn from this experience?
I think it highlights the importance of an all-hazards approach to early warning and early action, and the importance of understanding the vulnerability and exposure of the population to cumulative risks.
Thanks, David, for this item. I'm sure we're going to take this up during one of our future podcasts.
Well, that concludes this episode of the Weather Pod. We hope you found it of value. Alan and I will be back next month with another special guest to discuss a key topic in the global weather enterprise. Plus, of course, wow, that's interesting. Wow!